Hello, you are listening to the Charles Bonnet Syndrome Podcast. My name is Shaman Foy, and I have a special guest today. His name is Scott Muirden, and he's coming to us all the way from Australia. So how are you doing today, Scott?
I'm very well, Shaman. It's Saturday afternoon here, and I know it's Friday evening there, and it's a very hot one here today, over 100 degrees Fahrenheit.
Boy, oh boy, that's tough. I hope you can just get some relaxation and just enjoy this hot day, hopefully, under the air conditioning. Yeah, it's pretty nice here. It's only about 50 degrees here, you know, but that's such an amazing thing, this big old world that you're in the future, pretty much, you know, you're already in Saturday.
So, yeah.
So can you tell me a little bit about what it is that you do? I know you do a lot of things and you work with organizations and you help a lot of people, especially the visually impaired, but can you tell me a little bit about what you do?
Yeah, so I was actually wondering whether it might be helpful to go a little step back and actually look at my background and how I actually came to be involved with the foundation. So my background is in psychology, and as a result of that study, I ended up working in the mental health / psychiatry field. And for a lot of that time, I was working with young adults who'd had their first psychotic episode, and they would have been hospitalized in a psych inpatient unit. And then really my role was when they were being discharged back into the community. And so my role was to help assist the person, the young adults, to reintegrate into their community in terms of rebuilding bridges to education and social friendship networks and the like that had been disrupted by their mental health issues. And after quite some time in that field, I decided I wanted a change. And so I thought, well, what area do I want to move into? And I come from a family of vision impairment. So my mother was born with vision impairment and my brother as well. So because of that, I decided, all right, I'm going to now work in the vision loss field. And so I was working at the eye hospital here in Melbourne, and I started to come across these patients who were describing stories that were very similar to the world I had inhabited, my work world, for many years before that, but with a twist. And the twist was that they seemed completely lucid. Their minds were fine. And I thought, wow, this is really fascinating. And at that point, I had not heard of the syndrome. And so I continued to come across it. And as I noticed that it was quite common, that I started to ask around at the eye hospital and said, look, we're speaking to the superiors and said, look, you've got fact sheets for macular degeneration, glaucoma, cataracts, but we don't seem to have anything for Bonnet syndrome. And anyway, it just so happened that never got off the ground, and the fact sheets never appeared in the waiting rooms. And then I worked in other vision loss settings here and came across something very similar, that really working in the eye healthcare field, that you came to realize that Bonnet syndrome was really at the periphery of eye healthcare interest. And it was really shoved away. And again, that there was no one promoting it, no fact sheets. And at the low vision clinics that I used to work at, it was not routinely being asked about by the optometrist. So to fast forward then to your original question, Shimon, after many, many years of finding that the syndrome was conspicuous by its absence, and that despite my pleas to pick up their game, and that it was falling on deaf ears, that I decided to start up the organisation, Charles Bonnet Syndrome Foundation, and that occurred in 2012. And so we've been operating, this is our 12th year. What do I do there? Well, primarily there's two tasks that we have. It's obviously much larger than that, but one is providing direct service provision to those who are directly affected by the syndrome, and that includes carers who are indirectly affected by the syndrome. That's our core work. But because of what I outlined earlier, that Charles Bonnet syndrome continues to be incredibly well concealed, incredibly well hidden, that what we actually find is the second principal role that we're performing is that we're trying to raise awareness of the syndrome within the medical and healthcare sectors. And we're spending quite a bit of time in that space. And so one of the things that we have been able to establish is that we've got a working relationship with a university here, approaching a decade now, where we get to teach third year optometry students about CBS. And we also recently presented to PhD candidates within Melbourne University's optometry faculty. So we're really proud of that because we're hoping that fresh optometry graduates will be entering the field with a heightened awareness of the syndrome. But having said that, Shimon, structural barriers remain, and the real challenge in terms of, say, the optometry students is it's good that they're being well-versed in the syndrome before they get out into the field, but the real challenge is, will that translate to each optometry practice incorporating within its protocols, within its history-taking assessment procedure, whether it's going to include CBS as a small but integral part of the overall consultation process. That remains to be seen at this point in time, whether that sort of translation is going to occur.
You're doing so many things, and the history of you being a psychologist, because you are a psychologist, right?
I'm not a registered psychologist, no, but yeah, I did an honours degree in psychology.
Okay.
And after that, I also did a degree in social work.
So you can come at it from a different angle. You worked in various different fields, and then you have firsthand experience with people. Now, I don't know if your family members actually had Charles Bonnet syndrome, but they had visual impairments. So were you actually one of the founders of the Charles Bonnet Syndrome organization?
Yes, I was. And I was motivated by one thing, principally, that I was feeling for all those thousands upon thousands of vision impaired individuals throughout Australia who were suffering in silence, who didn't know where to go to turn to get the information they needed. All they knew was that they were having some very unusual visual experiences, and they were very worried about the implications of what that may mean for them. And as I guess is almost like a catch cry now within the CBS community, this is really encapsulated in the phrase, "First I lost my vision, am I now losing my mind?" And that's quite a common occurrence amongst vision impaired people who do start to see things that others are not able to see. And my heart was going out to them, because the way the medical and healthcare sectors work at present, as I alluded to a little bit earlier, is such that it's very easy for such individuals to fall right through the cracks. And where they can see orthoptists, their ophthalmologist or eye specialist, they can go to their optometrist or optician, and yet no one ever raises the topic. And they don't get the answers they need. And the flip side to that is that they don't want to bring the topic up because they're terrified of the implications. So things have to change, because as it stands at the moment, you've got these two unfortunate factors that are dovetailing to ensure that the syndrome is just not raised or broached in the entire consultation process. And getting back to what I told you about working at the eye hospital all those years ago, I mean, it was nearly 20 years ago now, no fact sheets in the waiting room area. So it's completely hidden. And you can understand why people are very reluctant to want to volunteer. Hey, I'm having these strange visual experiences. What's happening to me? Because they're worried that they may well be given a referral down the psychiatric path and all that that entails. And unfortunately, Shimon, this is actually occurring. We had a terrible case of a young woman in her 20s, diagnosed with glaucoma, being managed by glaucoma medications. But she started to see text in multiple languages, predominantly in English and Korean. And when she first had the experience, naturally, she was very concerned, so she went to her glaucoma specialist, told him about her symptoms. Now, he was worried that maybe something structurally was wrong with the eye, for example, like a retinal detachment. So he checked her eye and said, "Look, structurally, everything's fine." So she said in response, "Well, does that then mean that I'm crazy?" And she says that he didn't answer that question, but he did say, "If you continue to have such symptoms, then I would be going to your local emergency department." And she continued to see the text over the subsequent days. And so with promptings from friends, she went to the emergency department, and she was immediately made an inpatient of a psychiatric unit solely on the basis of seeing text. And she was in there for a week until her parents were able to get her out. So it's not just that people are fearful of speaking up because maybe they're going to tell me I've got dementia or I've got some psychiatric condition. These are real life examples where people have been misdiagnosed and are shunted down that path with horrible consequences. So you can understand why people are so reticent to speak up.
And I've heard so many stories like that of people that have been misdiagnosed and they've been labeled with dementia or some other kind of psychiatric problem, and that's actually not the case. So what you're doing is so important by bringing awareness out there. But I was thinking, going back to what you said about the doctoral students, you're bringing awareness to them, and that's great. And that's going to be very, very beneficial. But what I'm thinking is, what I'm wondering is, you had the awareness, and then maybe you could prevent situations like that. But what do you do beyond that? Because some doctors actually have said, I've heard them say with my loved one, and I've heard other people say, they said this to them, you have Charles-Bonnet syndrome, but there's nothing I can do about it. I can't make the hallucinations go away. And then they're still stressed, they're still frustrated, they're still upset. And I'm wondering, how do we bridge that gap? And is that possibly because of the fact that we don't really have any treatments for it? Because doctors usually address things medically. And if you don't have a pill to give or treatment, it's kind of hard for them to really bring things up because they don't really know what to do about that. I don't know if you have any thoughts about that.
Oh, well, yeah, I've got lots of thoughts on that. Look, there's so many different paths that one could go down in response to that. One that really strikes me is that really Charles Bonnet finds itself in this curious intersection between really three or four clinical specialities. So neurology, psychiatry, gerontology, which is those doctors who work with the elderly, and of course, ophthalmology. And part of the problem that we have, Shimon, is, and you're probably well aware of this, is that depending on what clinical speciality you go down, then they work with different criteria. And the other problem is that, for example, say you're a neurologist, you will look for CBS, but you may not take into account ophthalmological issues or psychiatric issues that may be relevant to the case. And that equally applies to, say, ophthalmology, that you can go to an ophthalmologist and they will make an assessment on whether you have Charles Bonnet, but maybe not take into account possible neurological issues that may be impinging on that particular person, as well as psychiatric issues, because sometimes ophthalmologists will say things to their patients like, look, I only deal with the eyeball, so you're going to have to go to a neurologist or you're going to have to go to a psychiatrist because we don't deal with that stuff. And so what's happening is that all these specialities are working in their clinical silos and they're not communicating with one another. And we would get better outcomes and better diagnoses if there was a multidisciplinary approach. So, for example, that if an ophthalmologist sees a patient or a client and suspects it could be Charles Bonnet, that they reach out to a neurologist, to a psychiatrist, to see whether they can add anything of value to understanding the case as a whole. And that's not happening at the moment. So that's one problem. The second problem, the one that you specifically raised, well, what do you do if you're told that you've got Charles Bonnet, but there's nothing I can do for you? There's no cure, there's no treatment. Well, in a way that's correct, but in another way it's not, because there are cases, documented cases, both in the medical journals as well as anecdotal evidence, where a prescribed drug brilliantly resolves the visions within a week or two. Now, unfortunately, that is more for the minority rather than the majority, but there are stunning cases of people's Charles Bonnet being resolved through a prescribed drug. And yet, though that same drug that had that wonderful response for one patient, for others it may have no positive effect at all. And even the opposite, sometimes it actually makes the visions worse. Plus, some of these prescribed medications, especially antipsychotics and anticonvulsants, they can come with quite a range of side effects. So one needs to tread very carefully in that area. Obviously, treatments are the cornerstone of what everyone is desperately seeking. But there are approaches that can be looked at that are non-medical, as in what we would be recommending is that you go through a number of looking at a person from in terms of what behavioral things they can do, their thoughts, looking at their reactions to the visions, that there are a number of things, and also tweaking the person's immediate environment. Now, so even before you get, we sort of see prescribed medication as a last resort. That's where you've tried all the other options and it's still really intrusive and it's really affecting the quality of your everyday life. Then maybe it's about exploring that. But we think that there are a range of strategies that can be explored prior to that. So, for example, with the tweaking of the environment, one thing is lighting. And, you know, one of the strange things, Shimon, about Charles Bonnet is that it's a very elusive creature and it's got all these unusual qualities to it where what works for one doesn't work for another and vice versa. But for example, what you'll often see in the reading is that if someone's vision impaired, they to be careful that they're not spending too much time in dimly lit rooms. And the belief that by being in a dimly lit room that you are actually increasing the sense of deprivation, sensory deprivation, and it puts you more at risk of the visions occurring. Now, that is true for some. And in those instances, we would be recommending that you get an orthoptist. I presume they're in North America, although I don't know for sure. But an orthoptist, one of their primary roles is being able to determine the optimal lighting for a person based on the type of eye disease or injury they have. And so a lot of people just tend to say, okay, I'm going to go out and get the brightest lights for my grandmother or my father, whatever. I'm going to get the brightest of bright. But that's not necessarily what the loved one needs. And so you really need someone who has expertise in that area to determine what is the best lighting. And then you can explore that. But then on the other hand, there are people we know where the opposite occurs, where it's actually glare that can trigger the visions. And so one also has to be aware of being able to provide, say, visual aids that can provide to shut out that really strong UV rays and to cut it out and therefore minimize the chance of CBS occurring. And again, like I said earlier about prescribed medication, where sometimes it has a miraculous response for the person. So too lighting. Sometimes just by being able to accommodate for glare and real light sensitivity, that can really reduce the visions. And there's a whole lot of other areas that probably we don't have time to go into now. But I think what's crucial, and maybe the doctors are overlooking this, is maybe from a medical point of view, they're saying, well, you've got dry macular degeneration, so there's really very little I can do for you. Now, that may be true on a medical level, but routinely the way doctors operate is that they normally will refer the person to additional support services based in their local communities. And this isn't happening at the moment, certainly not in Australia. I can't speak for other parts of the world, but it wouldn't surprise me that we're not. I think it's fair enough for an ophthalmologist to say, unfortunately, medically, we can't do really anything for your macula at the moment. But given that I do believe you have Charles Bonnet, then I would like to link you into these types of services. And one of them that I think is crucial is to be linked in or referred to a low vision service provider in your local community. Because what they can do is look at a whole range of issues that are where your vision loss is affecting the quality of your everyday life. And I believe that there's services there like the Lighthouse. I know there's the American Foundation for the Blind. There's others, obviously, but none others are coming to mind at the moment. But I would really be encouraging the person or their loved one to get assistance on the ground with issues around, all right, if we stick with macular degeneration, for example. So we know that the macula is in the center of the retina, and that's where your central vision is, and that's the cones and rods are there, which enable a person to be able to undertake fine detailed tasks like reading, like being able to do very intricate handwork, like handicrafts, sewing, things like that. You really need very good central vision for that. Now, given that the person unfortunately has damage to their macula, then one of the things you could be exploring at your local low vision service provider is, well, assuming this person has no other eye conditions, then their side vision or peripheral vision should still be healthy and intact. And then one of the roles that an orthoptist could play there is to teach the person how you can start to draw upon that side vision. And by doing that, it's one of many ways at such a service where you can explore optimizing the vision you still have left, whether it's to do with glare, whether it's to do with drawing upon your side vision, whether it's about learning how you can move around your environment safely and confidently through an orientation and mobility instructor. These are all really important factors that can really make a meaningful difference in a person's life, certainly on the level of improving the quality of life. But what we've found is that sometimes with these approaches, they can reduce the CBS as well. And in a way that makes sense, because one of the problems with CBS is that we know that stress or anxiety can exacerbate the syndrome. And unfortunately, when vision loss occurs, it can really start this uncomfortable spiral downwards, whereby the person starts to lose their confidence, they start to lose their desire to go out as much, their world starts to shrink, they're not going out and meeting friends as much as they used to, And in other words, their world's getting smaller. And that compounds the issue. Because they're now becoming, they're withdrawing more, then they are not getting social stimulation, they're not getting the support of others. And then there's a chance for them, for the person at home to be ruminating, worrying more about things, and it can just a bit like a what like the snowball coming down a mountain sort of metaphor, that it's gathering momentum, it's gathering more snow, and the ball's getting bigger. And one of the things that happens for a lot of people who acquire vision loss is that their confidence levels start to fall. They're starting to question their place in the world. And it can be quite almost an existential crisis. And they can start to feel somewhat helpless. And so for a lot of people who maybe before their vision loss led very rich lives, they were very assertive people, and now suddenly they've become a shadow of their former selves. What they really need at this point in time is to put the handbrakes on this downward spiral. And by referring people to a low vision service provider and getting supports there, learning from others, well, what did they do? How did they make adjustments to their life when they lost vision? How do you manage when you're out and about at a restaurant? And how do you, if you're feeling maybe self-conscious that you won't know where the food is on the plate and will I spill it and the like? There, that's where a low vision service provider can look at that with someone like an occupational therapist. So, and they can help with, say, applying makeup, about a whole range of things. And so you start to see that if someone can get the tips and assistance they need to start to feel like they're more on top of things, then this goes to circumventing this downward path of feeling more and more stressed and anxious. And that's one thing that we would strongly be recommending. Even if the doctors are not doing it, you could ask them to make a referral, but even so, do it on your own bat and follow that up. And to get involved in communities such as the one that we're involved in right now, to listen to these podcasts, to listen to the firsthand accounts of people's lived experiences and what they tried and found helpful. There is a lot that can be done. And so in a way, I think that at the moment that too many doctors passing the buck, so to speak. And one of the problems is that, so for example, here in Australia, we've been successful in getting the Royal College of Ophthalmologists here to develop a position statement on Charles Bonnet syndrome. It's available on our website. And it's really useful because it's a medical body who have the prestige of being a medical body. And so people take notice of their authority, and other doctors cannot dismiss such a document because it's not coming from outside the medical community, it's coming from within. Now, on the one hand, we think that that document is terrific and that they update it every few years. The problem, though, and I imagine that this is probably happening not just here in Australia, but worldwide, one of the problems is that it's one thing to write a document by a peak medical body on Charles Bonnet, but it's quite another that the medical peak medical body says, we feel so strongly about this issue that not only are we going to produce this document that you can download from our website, but that they are then going to disseminate that document to every one of their members. That would be the first port of call. And then the second beyond that is not only that they send it to every one of their members, but that they say you need to incorporate this into your consultation process. You need to ask, you need to raise the topic. And I don't know about in the States, but here in Australia, when you've got an IRA report, there's usually a little box down the bottom that the doctor can tick, and it says, do you consider this person to be legally blind? And they can tick that if it applies. One thing that would be great and that we would love to see the medical fraternity do is to include another one on that eye report that says two things. One, have I inquired as to whether this patient may have symptoms that are similar to or identical to Charles Bonnet syndrome? And two, if I've diagnosed them with it, what have I then subsequently referred them to? These are the sorts of structural, systemic changes that are desperately needed within the Charles Bonnet space. Because really, when you look at it, when you look at over the last 12 years, now, 12 years ago, there was not one Charles Bonnet organisation dedicated solely to the syndrome. Now we've got three, we've got two mooted that may be coming along quite soon. We've had some good things happen in the last 12 years, including this very podcast. So there's a lot that's been happening over the previous 12 years. But what you actually will find is that the vast majority of the changes that have been brought, that the bringing awareness of Charles Bonnet to the wider community, it's largely being led by those within the Charles Bonnet syndrome community. It's not largely being led by the medical and healthcare sectors. And that's where it's falling down. And that's where we need, that's the challenge that the Charles Bonnet cause, this is what is the main stumbling block at the moment. How we've got passionate people, either directly affected, indirectly affected, who find this either a fascinating condition, a scary condition, a terrifying condition, any or all of those three. But what we don't have is, at the moment, is we do not have across the board medical and healthcare sectors getting on board and giving it the clinical priority that it richly deserves. I mean, I understand, like everyone else, that no doctor can be expected to know every type of medical condition that exists in the world. That's just not realistic or practical. There's just too many. And a lot of them are very rare genetic conditions and the like. But what we've come to learn in recent times, even though historically and even though still in medical journals, specialists are referring to the syndrome as rare, we just simply know that's not the case. We know that the figures are really quite astounding. And therefore, on those grounds alone, by its sheer numbers, then it's time for the medical and healthcare community to really start to put in place those measures that I described earlier, because that in itself would be the way to avoid so much of that needless suffering that led me to found the organization back in 2012.
Well, your organization is leading the charge. Like you said, it's probably the oldest organization that's dedicated to Charles Bonnet syndrome. So we thank you for that. And thank you for all of the things that you are doing to bring awareness to it. It's probably going to have to be a grassroots effort, little by little, community by community, doing things on this podcast, doing pop-ups in the UK with Judith Potts. And now also we have Eva Potts, who's starting an organization, Mary Carmel's Light here in America, and just slowly bringing awareness, slowly talking to people, because the medical community is probably not just going to rewrite the medical books or add it to the curriculum to really get the awareness out there and spread it. And that's hard. It seems daunting, but we definitely can't give up because it affects so many people. And it's quite terrifying. I know some people actually like the hallucinations they see, and some people can stand them, but like Dr. Dominic Fitch said, it's actually about 33% of the people that get Charles Bonnet are terrified, and it turns their life upside down. And those are the people that we're really trying to help with this awareness. I think of what you said about the multidisciplinary approach, and I think that's what's needed. I think it's so difficult to do something on your own because you're either so busy or you have your own staff or your own crew to deal with. And then when you have to try to coordinate with a different doctor that has their own things going on, it can be difficult. And then here in America, you have HIPAA laws, so you can't really share information with other doctors, and it gets to be quite complicated. Nobody wants to get sued or lose a license. I don't know to what extent, you know, you can get in trouble, but that's difficult. I was thinking it'd be good if there could be like some kind of a voluntary database that can be either one in America, one in the UK, one in Australia, or maybe we can make it a worldwide thing where somehow, some way, we could figure a way to make it easy to update and easy to coordinate, to share some information so it won't be so siloed. I don't know if something like that's possible, but that definitely crossed my mind regarding some of the challenges and overcoming some of these things.
Oh, yeah, and you are right, Shimon, that that's not going to be easy to have that multidisciplinary approach because, as we all know, ophthalmologists are very busy and they simply don't have the time. But I think it could stop a lot of false positives as well as false negatives. Because I think at the moment there's a lot of misconceptions out there about the syndrome. And it doesn't help when we don't have a universally agreed upon definition of Charles Bonnet, and we certainly don't have universally agreed upon diagnostic criteria. So that also makes it very difficult, because which criteria do you follow? And there's no easy answer to that at the moment.
I think one of the things that's happening, because I've been fortunate enough to sit in on probably 100 Charles Bonnet syndrome support groups and meetings, and I heard one person so eloquently say that when people get older, their vision diminishes. And so most people that have Charles Bonnet syndrome are elderly, because that's when really a lot of the eye diseases and situations kick in. So when you're elderly, someone was saying they're usually kind of like, they are not this way, but some, for lack of better words, they can be like considered like outcasts, or, you know, like they're not really like contributing. They were saying, this is someone else's words, I'm paraphrasing it, to society and the way they used to when they were young. Maybe they're not as mobile, so they're not out in your face. You don't really see them and realize some of the things that's going on. And then also the stigma with hallucinations, people don't share it. So you're not really getting the words out there, and then you're not really helping them. And then you have a lot of people that are visually impaired, but so far it seems that Charles Bonnet only affects 30 to 40%. But when you have millions of people all over the world that have a visual impairment, and then you say 30 to 40% of them, and then you think about the stigma of people not really coming forth and saying that they are having hallucinations, the numbers are staggering. So,
yeah.
But I think for that, for those reasons, if it affected people that were a lot younger, and if everybody that was blind had it or something like that, it would be, we would be able to get much more awareness and much more resources, and it would be much easier to get some help. Another thing that I've heard is if we had a celebrity that had Charles-Bonnet syndrome, especially nowadays with all of the social media and influencers, if we had like, I'm not trying to wish anything on anyone, but he just popped in my mind, Mr. Beast. I never watched any of his videos, but he has the most, he's the biggest YouTuber, or somebody more influential, like a president or like a famous actor, then we could actually probably start really making some traction. But it's kind of hard to do that. Now, maybe someone that's famous may have a family member that has it. Or maybe if you are a famous actor, you don't even want to talk about it for the fact that you may not be able to get more work, or you don't want people to label you a certain way. But those are some of the concerns that I've heard shared and some suggestions, and I think they're all valid.
Look, it'd be great if we found that Taylor Swift has the condition, or she was here actually not long ago. And she actually said that when she was here in Melbourne that she'd never played in front of a larger crowd ever before. She played in front of 96,000 people. But yes, look, we are looking for a figurehead, so to speak, a spokesperson, someone who does have that gravitas, and people will listen. It will come along. We did have one in Oliver Sacks, but unfortunately he's no longer with us. And here we've got, with the Australian Football League, there was actually a player from the biggest club in the country, and his grandfather had the syndrome. And we were trying to, it was looking like it was going to come off for a while there, where that we were really going to give, it was going to get some serious traction. Unfortunately, it didn't quite come off. But yes, that would be great to have someone to be that spokesperson. That I think that would really facilitate the process.
Yeah, I think it's going to happen. And it may be someone that is not a celebrity and may become a celebrity because they're so outspoken, or maybe they're articulate, or maybe they have seized the opportunity. I'm trying to think of a saying.
And they may be very young too.
That's so true. I'm curious. Judith Potts does a whole lot for the community, and she's really working hard in the UK, and we all know and appreciate what she's doing. She mentioned that they have a lot of trials. She's working with doctors and even scientists. Are there any doctors or scientists that you're aware of in Australia that are running any trials or doing anything in the research field that you may want to highlight?
Look, the only one of any real interest was a woman called Vicky Hamilton, who is currently doing a PhD in Queensland. And she'd tried to recruit some members through the CBS community, and she's hoping to finish that in the near future. Now, I think what was really interesting about her study was two things. One, it was not focused so much on the brain as a lot of the studies are at the moment. But perhaps far more importantly is that Vicky herself has had Charles-Bonnet. So she was in that privileged position of being a researcher, but having gone through the experience herself. And so what she was looking at was trying to see whether there's any sort of connection between the type of thoughts that a person has and the narratives they share, as well as, and linking that to the content of their CBS visions, and trying to see whether there's any relevant connection there that can be teased out. And I, for one, find that area very fascinating. So that is one thing. But in terms of other research, look, we were really interested in doing what is being done in England, which is the transcranial magnetic stimulation because that is showing some promise. But what I would like to see, and it hasn't even happened yet, so if we get back to almost right at the beginning, Shimon, where you said that regularly people with CBS are told by their doctor there's no treatment, there's no cure. And then I gave the example of, well, yes, it's true that there is no safe and reliably effective drug on the market at the moment, but a minority do get great outcomes. And what I find remarkable is that there's about, give or take, there's about a dozen prescribed medications that have been prescribed to patients. So some of those are in the antipsychotic area. Some of those are anticonvulsant or like anti-seizure, say like with epilepsy drugs. But then there's other drugs not in those two areas that have also been used, which include antidepressants, drugs for anxiety and the like. And what is remarkable, I think, is that I don't think there has been any robust clinical trials anywhere in the world to determine the effectiveness of any of those prescribed medications for CBS. Because what we're doing at the moment is we're really just basing it on largely on case reports. It might be one, it might be three, where they say, oh, we gave this drug and we got this outcome. And then I think other doctors maybe read that and say, okay, they had success with drug X, so let's go with drug X. But none of those drugs, none of those prescribed medications have ever, as far as I'm aware, no one has ever really explored that anywhere to once and for all say, this is how effective all these different drugs that are currently being prescribed for the syndrome. This is it. This is where it stands.
Yeah, I do know that there. Oh, I'm sorry. I do know that there was some, like you said, kind of like a case study or small trials, but it was nothing extensive. But I do know that some of those that was based off data. Some of those drugs that you mentioned, anticonvulsants, antipsychotics, and specific drugs. I'm not going to mention any because I'm not a doctor or anything like that. But I have come across a list of some things that have been proven to help some people. But I have spoken to an ophthalmologist that told me pretty much what you said. Most of the time, it doesn't work. I know you said you had a person that you know that took some drugs and it actually helped them. And I don't know if that would have continued or maybe would have helped for a year. And then maybe you got to switch up or change the dose or change the drug or something. But this one ophthalmologist, and he seemed to be a good person. He really took some time to talk to me. And he was saying most of the time when you take drugs, it usually causes more harm than good. And that's the thing when you have antipsychotics and anticonvulsants and stuff, they are known to have serious side effects. And
they're powerful drugs and they're not to be messed with lightly, and especially with the people of advanced years. You've really got to give them in small doses because they're just too strong.
You said it best. If the CBS is to the point where it is just really unbearable and you just can't take it and it's very severe and it's very frightening and you kind of really don't have any quality of life because you can't sleep, you can't relax, then you have to try something because you can't live like that. If you're not sleeping, you're not eating or falling down and getting injured, you may have to, but you definitely have to talk to your doctor if that is the case.
Well, the one thing I would say to that, Shimon, and I mention it a lot, but I can't stress this enough. If you're going to go down that path where you really want to explore for either yourself or a loved one, a prescribed medication, then make sure that you find out from the doctor, that they lay it on the table, what are the possible pros and cons of this approach? Now, we know the pros. Hopefully it's going to get rid of these tormenting visions. But often they'll not talk about the cons, and you need to know what you need to be able to make an informed decision, or the family does. And if you can be told up front, look, we think that this has a good chance, it's shown a record of some success, but be aware that it can sometimes lead to the following side effects. Well, then you can weigh that up, or the family can, to decide, well, do we want to take that risk? And then you can make an informed decision, rather than just being so desperate that you take whatever is given to you. Because, as I said about the syndrome, seems to be quite mercurial, that, and it certainly is when it comes to prescribed medications, where it has no effect on one person, it works really well for another, and then others, it can sometimes even make their visions worse. We've come across instances of that, where the medication makes it worse. You might have had, I don't know, let's say intrusive visions of a monkey in a top hat dancing on the kitchen bench, and you were sick and tired of it. It was ongoing and relentless. But then you take this medication, and now it's ballooned into something far more perhaps sinister or ugly or anxiety producing, and then you're thinking, gee, I wish I just had that monkey now with the top hat dancing. So you've got to be really careful in that space. It's a real hit and miss at the moment.
Yes.
Yeah.
What is your website? I'm going to put it in the show notes, but if you can verbally say it, just in case someone wants to visit your website.
Yeah, it's quite easy, actually. It's just Charles Bonnet Syndrome. All one word, Bonnet, Bonnet, .org, O-R-G.
Okay, all right. So I'll definitely put that in the show notes, and I'm going to add your email in case anyone would like to contact you. And would you mind saying your email verbally also, just in case someone has a visual impairment and can't see the show notes or something?
Well, I guess there's two. If you want to just contact the foundation, it would be info@charlesbonnetsyndrome.org. Or if you'd like to reach me personally, then it's Scott with one T, also at charlesbonnetsyndrome.org.
Oh, thank you very much. And I asked this question to a lot of guests because I think it's a question that is important to ask. If there's someone that's listening to this podcast and they are having a difficult time with Charles-Bonnet syndrome, what advice would you give to them?
I think the first thing I would do is encourage them to reach out to others that they feel they can trust, that who will be non-judgmental, who'll be empathic, and supportive. Now, maybe that might just be telling a relative or a friend or a neighbour. It's a bit difficult because if I knew a bit more about the context, if this person is really finding a hard time, have they had any contact with any relevant services? I was answering my question on the basis that maybe they're really just remaining quite isolated. They haven't reached out to anyone or any services. But if they have, I would be encouraging them to reach out to others who are also living with the syndrome. And I just don't think that can be underestimated. There's something really, a lot of people with Charles Bonnet when they first start having the symptoms and they're new to it, they've never heard the word, the medical name before, many of them say that I thought I'm the only one in the world who's going through this. So to actually find out that there are others going through something similar, obviously different, but with some similar qualities, I would be encouraging them to reach out, because it's through talking and opening up and sharing one's experiences in that supportive environment that some of the burden, the weight that you're carrying, can be lifted. And maybe it just so happens that the person that you're talking to, in this case, another person living with the syndrome, that maybe they might just be able to provide some tips or pointers as to how they've learned to manage the syndrome better.
That's so important. And here in the States, in the U.S., we actually have Dr. Gary Cusick has a weekly Charles Bonnet Syndrome support group, and it's held at from 12 p.m. or 12 noon to 1 p.m. And then at 1 o'clock, he actually has a support group that follows it. And if you want information about that, you can see it in the show notes, but you can also email me at cbsyndromepodcast@gmail.com. So that's cbsyndromepodcast@gmail.com. And I also know that Jonathan Ward in the UK, he's works with the Pocklington Trust, the organization out there. They have a bi-weekly support group, and it's held on Thursdays bi-weekly. I know there's one in Canada. I don't want to mess up her name. I don't want to say the name. I'm working with her to do one of the leaders for the CNIB, I believe is what they call it, their organization for the blind and visually impaired.
You're talking about Lucia?
Yeah, Lucia. I think she has some support groups also. And Lucia is going to be a podcast guest sooner than later. We've been in communication. And I'm sure there's some in Australia. Are there some support groups either virtually or in person in Australia?
There's no physical support groups anymore. The COVID changed that. But yeah, we do have online communities. Yes.
So they
I just wanted to quickly go back and say one other thing that I would recommend to.
Certainly.
Is whoever you reach out to, someone you trust, and is going to be non-judgmental, I would be asking them to find a person or persons who can help them identify any possible triggers for their CBS. And that maybe that person or persons can help to assist them in minimizing or avoiding such situations and encouraging the person to engage more fully in activities that they enjoy. Because often when people are really engaged in something where they're really giving their time and attention to, that they can be less aware of the syndrome during such times. So when I'm talking about triggers, it could be, is it stress-related? We certainly know that there are instances where it's people are worrying perhaps more than they usually do about maybe something that's not directly related to the syndrome, maybe just something in their private lives or family situation, work. Try to notice whether the syndrome is occurring that gives hints to the fact that, is it saying, well, have you noticed it's always happening when you're in this particular room? Or have you noticed it tends to be happening when you are outdoors and you don't have anti-glare glasses on? Sometimes people can find, when they really start to map their CBS experiences across a day and night, that you can start to identify that there's certain triggers, such as environment or internal feelings, that maybe you could be picking up on that could be helpful.
That's so good. One thing that I've heard some people say that have CBS is journaling helps them. And that ties into what you were saying, thinking about how you feel and what are the triggers. And if you're journaling something, you can look back and say, okay, well, wow, that was what I was going through, or this is what I was dealing with, or this is how I felt, or this is the type of day that I had. So some people have said in support groups that that helps. So I think that's great.
Exactly. It really doesn't matter what it is, as long as it's something that provides an outlet, a creative, expressive outlet. So not journaling's one. Maybe it could be that you're really into pottery or writing, and you can create something out of the clay that speaks to your CBS. There's something very intrinsically therapeutic, I think, about externalizing one's internal experience, and whether it's through getting words onto a page through journaling, or whether it's through creating some sort of sculpture or the like. But when someone has something that they can channel their energies into, I think that's something to really be promoted and encouraged.
I actually know two playwrights that are visually impaired, and they're writing plays about CBS, and the main characters in the play have CBS. One is in the UK and one is in the United States here. And they actually were both on the podcast. Antoinette was, I think, episode 2, and then Robin, a gentleman named Robin. And I don't know when his episode is going to come out, because I have a few episodes that I have to edit, but it was a very good episode. And I find that when you have things, hobbies and interests, it can be good in general, because you can maybe feel stressed, but when you're painting, you feel relaxed, or when you're playing the drums or whatever it is, you feel at peace. So, and you also think about your hobbies too, and think about your interests, and thinking about that or something positive instead of something that is a little bit negative can be helpful.
I think sometimes we can have habitual responses to things, just anything in life. And in the case of CBS, I think sometimes people can get locked into a sort of a set or standard emotional reaction to its appearance or reappearance. And what we might encourage is that try to see whether you can shift the person's viewpoint of their visual phantoms from, for example, from a problem, something that's annoying, to something to marvel at. And sometimes it's that reframing, the looking at the visions in a fresh way, sometimes that can be a circuit breaker.
You may not be able to stop the visions, but you can change how you think about the visions or the way you react to them. And that they say cognitive behavioral therapy is something that's actually listed. Dr. Gary Cusick actually said that that's listed in some literature, because he's a researcher and psychologist and a doctor. And he said that that's listed as one of the treatments. And he says a lot that he believes the key, or at least one of the keys to helping deal with Charles Bonnet syndrome, is to actually have like talk therapy or support groups and things like that. So it's a combination. It's probably just not one thing, but it seems like those types of things, reframing your mind, talking to a therapist, going to support groups, is going to be a way to really help combat it and adjust. How can somebody help your organization and help the cause with what you're doing in Australia?
Australian listeners could become involved in the foundation, help out. For example, we have a peer support program whereby we try to link someone who's recently started to experience Charles Bonnet, and they're relatively new to the syndrome and they're still trying to find their way, and we link them with someone who's been living with the syndrome a long time. And again, getting back to that idea of support, mutual support. And in this case, the real value of another person who knows what you're going through. Maybe not exactly, but they've lived or are still living with the syndrome. And I don't think that aspect can be underestimated. The value of for the new person to be able to share their experiences with another and to hear how that person, the wisdom of time and experience, things they've picked up on the way, little tips that have helped them that they can impart to this person. So certainly one thing that would be great is any Australians who'd want to help out in that role in the foundation. And just like Judith's in America, we're always looking for funds to keep doing what we're doing. So we do have a donate now button on our homepage to help us try to fulfill our mission statement. Yeah.
Yeah, that sounds great. Yeah, you're doing so many great things with the organization, and that's something that you could have mentioned in early on, but there's so many things, it's hard to mention everything, but pairing people together and so many other things that you're doing that we probably haven't even had an opportunity to talk about. So I just appreciate you and your organization, and you've even helped me with my family member who has Charles-Bonnet syndrome. When we reached out for support, you have done that, and many other people know you and have reached out to you, and you always are helpful and supportive. So we appreciate that.
Oh, you're welcome, Shimon. I think it's a great little community that we've started to build, and hopefully it's only going to blossom in the future.
Yeah, I truly believe it will. It's going to be more awareness and more help, more hope, and some changes, you know, definitely for the good.
But what would be great, I mentioned earlier that I don't believe there's been any clinical trials to establish the true effectiveness or otherwise of a whole range of medications out there. I don't think there's no pharmaceutical companies. That would be great if pharmaceutical companies would put in to undertake research to try to find a new medication. Now, I think I do appreciate that one of the difficulties in doing that at the moment is that we don't actually know the cause. So normally when it comes to developing a drug, you need to know the specific cause to know how to try to address it. So I do acknowledge that that's a difficulty. But it would be good if maybe there was some research going into trying to explore maybe new drugs rather than just pre-existing ones to see whether they can fit with the Charles-Bonnet experience.
Yeah, that would be great. And also some more research to figure out why one person gets it and another person doesn't get it, or one person gets it for 12 months or 18 months and another person has it for 18 years. And those things can be a little more challenging, but that could help develop a drug or some kind of a treatment when we start to understand the differences. And I just think that although this is a medical condition, the brain is involved. So it's not dementia or something that's a mental condition, but the brain is involved because the brain is such a, you know, it helps with vision. It works like that, visual cortex and all these terms and things that I probably don't even really know well because I'm not a doctor. But the brain is just so complex, and it's very challenging. Like if it was maybe a heart, you can probably deal with it a little. Not that that's not complex, but you can take a pill and help with your blood flow or whatever the case may be. But when it comes to the brain, it could probably be challenging. This was something that was discussed in a support group that I was in, and this is probably more for a caregiver, but if someone has Charles-Bonnet syndrome, let's put Charles-Bonnet syndrome on the side for a second. If someone has a frightening dream and they wake up and they're terrified, it may take them some time to get settled and realize it was just a dream and kind of forget that. But Then they went back to sleep and they experienced it again. They're going to be frightened, even though they know it was just a dream. And that's kind of like one thing that we were all coming to a conclusion in that support group, that Charles Bonnet, as an analogy, could kind of be like, it's like, don't be too insensitive and say, oh, it's just a dream, because dreams affect us. Our hearts beat faster and we get terrified and we wake up. And then what if you had a recurring dream and you went back to sleep and kept having the same type of dream again and again? It could be difficult. And sometimes when you're in the dream, you know it's a dream, and sometimes you don't. So, because I was going to ask you, what would you say to someone that is a caregiver and they're having a difficult time? So what comes to my mind is patience. But I don't know if you have any thoughts about that, because it's tough being a caregiver for someone with Charles-Bonnet syndrome.
Well, I think you've raised a really interesting thing about caregivers, because often they're the ones who are really left behind. And I know this isn't directly answering your question, but I think watching a loved one over time who is distressed by their CBS symptoms can take its toll on the carer. And I think it's really important that the carer recognises that they have their own limits. They're not an endless supply of patience and love and support, and that each and every one of us can tip over. We're not like supermen or superwomen. And to acknowledge that you've got limits and to be able to reach out for support if you're finding the role is becoming exhausting. And you could start by drawing upon family or friends or neighbours for help. But, you know, even if there's no one to turn to, reach out to a carer support service that exists in your local area. And I don't think there's anything to be ashamed of in reaching out for carer support, because really the role that carers undertake is really unbelievable. So many people who are giving out of love and concern for the well-being of someone very dear to them, and it really pains them to see them suffering. It pains them to feel that maybe I don't know how to really be of assistance at times, maybe feeling they're floundering. I think it's okay to recognize if at times that maybe your energy levels or fuel levels are getting low, and maybe it's time to restock. And if you feel you don't have the means to by which to do that on your own, then please reach out to carer services that are in your community. That's what they're there for. And, you know, I think we all know that the value of what you can give a loved one is based on where you're at. And so if you're feeling depleted, exhausted, then that's going to affect the quality of what you can give to the person you love and care for.
It's two things I want to say. The first thing is, just because you have Charles-Bonnet syndrome doesn't mean you don't have another condition or you won't develop another condition, because that's quite possible. And some of the things that I and other people that have been on support groups and in meetings have heard will lead us to believe that. We never come to that conclusion. We never judge anybody, but it is possible, you know, so that's one thing. And then the second thing I want to say is, because I read the book Hallucinations by Dr. Oliver Sacks, and pretty much what I got from that is there are a lot of things that can cause hallucinations. And switching away from that for a second, if you just have CBS and you have a severe case of CBS where it's really frightening, it's really disturbing, it really turns your life upside down, you live in constant fear, stress, you don't sleep well, and your thoughts are like negative, you can actually develop other things. Now, I'm not saying it's going to be like a medical condition, but just having anxiety can cause problems. Just being sleep deprived can cause more hallucinations or different types of hallucinations. So a combination of those two. When you get older, things happen to your body, or even if you're younger, sometimes things happen. So it could be other things where you got to talk to a doctor or professional to rule that out. And then if you live with this constant fear and anxiety, it can cause other problems in your life.
You've made a very good point there, Shimon, that especially because sometimes there are instances, as you alluded to, where there's something going on for the person that may be the real cause of the visions. And it's so whenever someone goes to their doctor and they're trying to ascertain whether it might be Charles Bonnet, then they need to be really exploring all medical possibilities to account for the visions. And in fact, this isn't really happening. I don't think this is really happening on the ground really anywhere, but the syndrome is known as a diagnosis of exclusion, which means that you first have to rule out all other possible medical explanations for why the person is having the visions. And one area of that is the type of medications you're currently on. And we've come across many instances where it's actually maybe a medication they've been on for quite a while. It was recently increased in dosage. You're able to see there's a time correlation that it's actually when that drug was increased in dosage, that's when the visions either commenced or when they became more severe. Sometimes, so you really need to be thorough and you really need to find out to do all those blood tests that doctors often do. Blood tests to see whether you've got any electrolyte imbalance. Are your sodium levels getting low? Are you very low in vitamin B12? There are all these different possibilities. And I think that's a really important part of when you go to see a doctor, to make sure that those other areas are covered and then ruled out.
Sometimes you need a brain scan too. And they'll order that just to make sure that there's no abnormalities or no growths or anything in the brain too. So that's I like what you said about
it's wide reaching.
Diagnosis of exclusion. That is so true. One thing that came to my mind that I want to discuss is I was listening to a podcast for caregivers. And the host said that over 30% of caregivers die before the patient that they're caring for. And that just blew my mind. And I was like, wow. So then they also said that if the person has dementia or Alzheimer's, which is the most common type of dementia, that is over 40%. That's really high. And that let me know that me as a caregiver myself, that I have to make sure that I take care of myself and do the things I need to do to make sure I'm okay for myself and my family, and even for the person that I care for. So that was just really alarming to know how difficult it is to be a caregiver and the amount of stress that it can cause.
Yeah, and it can be so subtle. I used that snowball analogy before at the beginning of the call, and it just very slowly, subtly builds up, and you may not be aware of it occurring in your body, let alone your emotions. And yes, and I think the additional problem in the caring role is that it's it's premised on being unconditional. So we love this person, and we will do whatever it takes to make them feel more comfortable, more at ease, and we will go to whatever lengths are necessary. And yes, it is about being able to notice, to try to be in touch with your body and your heart, to know whether the role may be starting to take its toll upon you.
I really like what you said. We are not supermen and superwomen. We're not machines, we're humans. And humans have to eat, they have to sleep, they have to take care of themselves. And that was really something that I'll take, and I'm sure other caregivers may take from this episode. I appreciate this. It was just so many interesting things that you brought up and that we were able to discuss, and it was so important. I'm sure this will help a lot of people by hearing your perspective and to just address some of these things and sharing the tips. And I just appreciate your time and all the things that you do for people that have Charles-Bonnet syndrome and their caregivers, and helping the organization, taking the time to talk on this podcast, and all the other things you do. So thanks.
Thank you, Shimon. And thank you to what you have initiated with this podcast in conjunction with EVA. You need to be also acknowledging some of the good work that you're also doing. So thank you for your time.